Welcome to this episode of the Insights Podcast on the Acadia Broadcasting Network. I'm Don Mills.
And I'm David Campbell.
I've been wanting to have a conversation with Phil Noll for at least a year. I started talking to him about that about a year ago. Phil is a well-seasoned and veteran executive in the oil and gas industry. And he comes from Atlantic Canada. He had to go away to begin his career out west. He's worked with some of the most significant oil and gas organizations in North America. He's wildly experienced. And more importantly, he's had some significant roles in Atlantic Canada, including Maritime and Northeast Transmission and also Corridor Resources. And he continues to be active on the boards of two companies with interest in Atlantic Canada. So he's a great source to talk about the opportunities and challenges of developing natural resources in our region.
That's right. And we had a really good conversation. I mean, he's convinced, and I think there's quite a bit of data to suggest that there's going to be lots of natural gas used around the world into the 2040s and beyond 2050. Maybe combined with carbon capture and storage, but that natural gas is going to be used for several decades. And, New Brunswick and Nova Scotia import on average around $400 million worth of natural gas from as far away as Alberta and Pennsylvania, while we have it right here in our local market. So that's always kind of stuck in my craw. And I was involved back then trying to convince people that we needed to develop the industry. But Phil gives us a good story. He talks about offshore Newfoundland and Labrador natural gas. He talks about the difference in carbon emissions between gas, oil, and coal. Talks about the natural gas system here in the Maritime. So there's a real good primer here, Don, for people who want to understand about the natural gas sector with some perspective specifically on our region. Of course, he mentions that we now have some of the highest gas prices, natural gas prices in North America. And that's true. I mean, I the last time I looked at the data, I think Hawaii actually was the only place that had higher natural gas prices than Atlantic Canada.
You know, our conversation ties nicely into the conversation that we had with Peter Gregg, the CEO of Nova Scotia Power, who made it pretty clear that the only way that they're going to be able to get off coal is to replace it with natural gas, and that in fact, in order to guarantee the base load for the system, they're going to need to continue to use those plants and natural gas to generate electricity. And you know, this is one of the things that we've been hearing through the podcast is that, you know, the oil and gas sector is not going to be gone by 2050. It's going to continue well beyond that. The industry is getting cleaner. They're finding ways to reduce the carbon footprint of that sector. They expect it to get close to net zero at some point. It's part of the portfolio approach to providing energy that we've heard time and again. Doesn't matter who's talking, whether it's somebody talking about green energy or small modular reactors or offshore wind or solar. They all say it's a piece of the solution. It's not the single solution. And so, you know, I think the importance of this podcast for people is to understand that the role of natural gas is going to be continuing for some time across the world and in our region. But the real question is, can we unlock the resources of natural gas that we have in this region and start to benefit from them here? He mentioned something really important. You know, the McCully field, which is now producing, the only producing natural gas field in Atlantic Canada, it only does it seasonally, has reserves of about 60 BCFs, billion cubic feet of natural gas. Currently, all of Atlantic Canada, for both industrial use and residential use, use less than one BCF a year. So that one field can supply the region for at least 60 years if it were to develop. And all the money that's being spent to bring gas in from other jurisdictions, the $400 million, which is going to go up, will all remain, you know, in this region. That is the opportunity that's so important for people to realize.
Absolutely. And he, that's why I asked him the question about how much it costs to build the transmission infrastructure to get the British Columbia natural gas to the LNG facility in British Columbia. And he said it was about $14 billion because it only cost Corridor something like $10 million, $10 million with an M, to connect the McCully field to the major Maritimes and Northeast natural gas transmission infrastructure. So the gas is there. It's close to the major infrastructure. It sits in the back door of New England. As he pointed out, we have very large industrial use of gas already. Almost every single large manufacturing plant in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia uses natural gas. So yeah, that's the big question is we're going to be using it now for a while. Where is it going to come from? Is it going to come from a local source, or is it going to come from as far away as Alberta and Pennsylvania? And I don't know, Don, your thoughts there. I don't know that he's particularly optimistic about the future of natural gas development in our region.
Well, he mentioned that's going to take billions of dollars, to develop. And the company that currently is developing the McCully field, it's not big enough to do it on their own. They're going to have to find other partners to do that. But they're also going to have a regulatory environment that allows them to make that sort of investment. But, you know, one of the things that Phil talked about as an example of another jurisdiction who has figured it out is BC, which probably has some of the most stringent environmental laws in the country. They've been able to figure out how to produce natural gas, mainly through fracking, safely, and to build up the royalties going to the government to be larger than forestry and expected to grow even further with the opening of the LNG export plant. So, you know, if BC can figure it out, certainly New Brunswick can figure it out, don't you think? I mean, you live in New Brunswick. Don't you think New Brunswick can figure it out?
It's a fantastic parallel. I mean, BC is considered the greenest province in the country. They were the first to implement a carbon tax many years before the federal tax. You know, they've done a lot to green their economy, but at the same time, they were developing their natural gas. They're actually an exporter of coal. A lot of people don't realize that, but they continue to export coal out of BC ports. So you know, they did a really great job partnering with First Nations. You know, they've done a lot of other things extremely well. And at the end of the day, they're growing, dramatically growing their natural gas industry, as Phil talked about. And as you say, the royalties from natural gas now exceed all the royalties from the entire forestry sector in BC.
And one final point. Phil said that if that one field were developed, it would mean billions of dollars in royalties to the province of New Brunswick over, you know, a fairly long period of time. So big opportunity for the province in that. And so we wanted to do this conversation to add to the debate about the development of natural resources in this region, which has been challenging. Just a quick note before we start the conversation with Phil Knoll. During the conversation with Phil, he mentioned that the reserves in the Fredericton Rock Basin, where the McCully operation is, it was estimated to be 60 BCF of gas reserves, or billion of cubic feet. What he meant to say was 60 TCF of gas reserves, which is trillion cubic feet. So he wanted that correction before the conversation. And with that rather long introduction, here's a really interesting conversation with Phil Knoll, the former CEO of Corridor Resources. We are pleased to have Phil Knoll as our guest on the Insights podcast for this episode. Phil is a veteran senior executive in the oil and gas sector, as well as the former CEO of Corridor Resources. Phil is currently on a number of boards, including UltraGas Inc., Headwater Exploration, which is formerly Corridor Resources, and Eastward Energy, formerly Heritage Gas. Welcome to the podcast, Phil.
Thank you, and hello to Don and David.
I'm glad you're here. So before we start talking about natural gas, we'd like to give our listeners a little bit of background on yourself. Don just mentioned some of the things you're involved with these days, but can you tell us a little bit about your background? You were born in Pictou County, and you've had a long and distinguished career in the oil and gas industry, including working with large firms like Duke Energy. Can you give our listeners a little summary of your career from start to where you are today?
Sure, and I'll be fairly quick. As you say, I was born in New Glasgow, Nova Scotia, graduated from St. Yvette's, and then went on to graduate from Nova Scotia Technical College with a degree in chemical engineering, which, of course, is now part of Dow. Almost immediately after that, I moved out west because at that time in the 70s, that's where the opportunities were for almost all of us. That's not the case anymore, but anyhow, that's where we went. So when I went out there, I immediately went into the oil and gas industry and worked for a number of significantly sized companies like Alberta Natural Gas, TransCanada Pipeline, which is now TC Energy, West Coast Energy, etc. And that took me, and in during that time, up until around 2000, I worked on numerous projects, including some projects in the Maritimes, like, as an example, Trans-Maritimes Pipeline, which was, as you know, David, was going to be a pipeline built from an extension of the Trans-Canada system in Quebec down into New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. It never got built, unfortunately, but that's another story. In 2000, we moved back to Halifax, and I took the role of president of Maritimes and Northeast. We were just completing the building of that pipeline, and I oversaw that in the operation of that pipeline and some other assets for Duke Energy until 2005. I then formed my own consulting company, working on development of energy projects in Eastern Canada and the Northeast U.S. In 2010, I took on the role of CEO of Corridor Resources, which was in the process of developing natural gas production in the Sussex area in New Brunswick. And in fact, that production is still ongoing and is the only production left in the Maritimes for natural gas, unfortunately. And then about 2015, I decided to step back a bit. It had been 35 or 40 years in the business. So I left Corridor and joined a number of boards, some of which have been mentioned and some of which I was on and companies were sold, etc. And here I am today. I'm still very involved in those boards and the industry. It's very interesting to me, particularly around the energy transition issues that we all face in Canada and, frankly, worldwide.
So can you just tell us a little bit more about what you're doing today? What's your current involvement in the oil and gas sector?
Well, I sit on a number of boards that Don's already mentioned, and that fortunately gives me involvement in a number of energy projects, not just in Western Canada, but also with utilities in the United States and Nova Scotia, and a lot of work on energy transition with those companies.
So let's talk about your industry today, which faces a number of challenges as the world moves to renewable energy sources. Many people have the expectation that the oil and gas industry will eventually disappear completely. David and I don't actually agree with that, but let's begin by talking about the current demand for oil and gas and where the demand will go over the next few decades. So what is the current demand and where is that demand expected to be by 2050, which is the target for net zero?
Sure. Well, let's talk about first for oil. There's lots of numbers out there and a lot of projections. But the common thought is that the use of oil will peak in the next 3 or 4 years, certainly by 2030, and start a slow decline. For natural gas, which happens to be a very important transition fuel, whether we like it or not, it's necessary, that the production and usage of natural gas will probably peak under the present models in around 2045, quite possibly 2050, and then decline after that. They're the two major, you know, components of the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, but to be clear, we're still going to be using fossil fuels beyond that, right?
Oh, 100%. Unless there's technology that comes around in the next 20 or 30 years that hasn't been identified yet that can negate that usage, I think it's relatively impossible, my view, that we won't be using significant amounts of oil and natural gas well beyond 2050. That doesn't mean we can't be approaching, at least in the developed nations, net zero. But no, that usage is going to go on for quite some time.
And this is the thing that we think the public doesn't really understand, because they feel that by 2050 we'll not be using fossil fuels anywhere in the world. And, you know, the expectation needs to be set properly that unless something changes, as you mentioned, you know, we're still going to need fossil fuel for some applications for sure. Now, the oil and gas industry has invested heavily in reducing its carbon footprint. Can you give our listeners some examples of those efforts and the progress that has been achieved to date in reducing the carbon footprint of the oil and gas industry?
Sure, and this is of particular importance, particularly in the developed nations, and I would say Canada is a leader in that, as is the U.S. in terms of reducing emissions. Right in the production phase, there's been a lot of work done to reduce the flaring of gas and use all that captured gas as a fuel to produce energy. There's a lot of technology been developed around the production and transmission of natural gas and oil, for that matter, around monitoring leaks and spending the capital to reduce the leakage of any of these products. And that continues. Another good example of how we're reducing methane emissions for the major distribution companies is in North America, a lot of the distribution companies are relatively old. They're aged. So the pipes have leaks. And there is a tremendous amount of capital being spent across North America to renew the system and reduce the leaks of methane and other pollutants. And that will go on for a number of years to come. Now, in a new utility like the ones in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, the systems are practically brand new, so they have very low leakage rates. Finally, where most of the capital is going to reduce CO2 emissions in the oil and gas industry is in carbon capture. So that's carbon capture, capturing the CO2 to manufacture the carbon dioxide into other products, other carbon products. And more importantly, sequestration of carbon, which is in both Canada and the U.S. starting to occur in a significant amount. And however, we haven't got to scale on that. And to get to scale on carbon capture and sequestration is going to take some time, and I dare say some help from government. It's getting that to scale is going to take a huge amount of capital, but it certainly, in my view, will occur.
So natural gas is positioned as more environmentally friendlier than oil. Can you help our listeners understand that? Can you tell us what the difference is in terms of the amount of carbon produced and the environmental impacts of natural gas versus oil?
Yeah, sure. To give you an example, I'll start with coal, replacing coal with gas. Coal expels about 45% more CO2 than natural gas when under the combustion of the product. Oil produces about 20 to 25% more CO2 than gas when burnt. Now, that's not completely apples to apples, because natural gas systems deliver the product pretty well right to the burner tip right to your home or right to your stove, et cetera, in pressurized systems. Whereas if you're using heating oil, that oil has to be railed to locations, and then it has to be trucked to homes. And there's a lot of emissions and inefficiencies in those systems that aren't caught up in the numbers I've relayed to you. And then there's just the pure technology, the efficiency of the systems. So natural gas burner systems are very efficient. Aged oil furnaces are far less efficient. But the number is roughly 25% less CO2 from natural gas. And also, I should mention, of course, oil and coal have numerous other pollutants that are during the combustion process that are released.
You mean like some sort of particulate matter? Or?
The technology is there to remove the particulate, but there's other emissions such as NOx, NOx, that occurs in both of these products, and in the case of coal, other emissions which are quite toxic. Yes, there are scrubber systems available to reduce that, but they're not 100% effective.
So one of the things that's happened in the U.S. is there's been a lot of migration from coal-fired electricity to natural gas production, and that's led to a significant decrease in overall emissions. There's in Canada, we're looking to sort of bypass that stage and go right to fully clean electricity by 2035. I think that's the federal goal. Don and I talked to the president of Nova Scotia Power, and they're looking at using either natural gas or oil when they come off coal, at least in a transition phase, at least to do the peaking. We wanted to get your thoughts on the use of natural gas to produce electricity as opposed to things like wind and solar and backup battery storage. Is there a case to continue using natural gas to make sure we can heat our homes and businesses in February in this country?
Well, not only is there a case, it's an absolute necessity. Renewable power isn't available 100% of the time. The amount of battery storage one would need to back that up is immense. And it's the capital required to do that and the technology required to do it isn't clear yet. Unless you're wanting to spend an enormous amount of money, which most people wouldn't be able to afford. So what you have with natural gas, not only as baseload production to replace coal now, what you have with natural gas is it's a quick response system. So if you have your wind not blowing or your sun not shining or the waves not pushing your turbines, you can turn on natural gas power plants very quickly. And they provide the backup we will need for a long time to come as we build up renewable systems and other storage systems to ensure that that happens. And that is why I tell you, natural gas is the projections are natural gas usage will grow up until 2045, maybe 2050, because of the need for that fuel as a transition. The storage systems, and they're getting better, and they will get better, have a long ways to go before they can truly back up renewables.
That's a good way to get into the next area of discussion, Phil. Atlantic Canada has had limited access to natural gas to provide energy for industry and home heating. You're involved with a company that's providing the distribution system in Nova Scotia for that, of course. One of the reasons is, reliable supply of natural gas, the demise of Sable Gas, the pipeline issues, have really been limited, to some extent, the natural gas that's available. But I really want to talk about what are the best opportunities to develop natural gas within Atlantic Canada, both onshore and offshore. We're going to talk about New Brunswick specifically, but in general, let's talk about the bigger opportunity.
And I'm happy to do that, Don, but I want to mention one thing. When you talk about the natural gas distribution systems in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, one of the most important factors about those systems is that they're providing a necessary fuel to industry in both of those provinces, to big industry. Mm. And mm. those big industries can't function on electrical supply. They need a more significant fuel to provide the heat requirements they have than the electrical system can provide. And those industries are responsible for a huge part of the economy in both of those provinces. So we need that natural gas supply in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, not just for heating homes and businesses, but the industry absolutely needs this fuel. And it's something that has to be stressed. It's well known in industry, but it's not well known by the public.
Right.
Now, to go back to your original question, what are the potential sources for natural gas in the Maritimes? Well, there's really two possibilities. One of them is offshore gas. Now, offshore Nova Scotia, the likelihood for continued or renewed exploration under the present commodity pricing is very low. Natural gas is relatively at a very low price right now, if you look back in history, on a relative basis. Offshore Newfoundland, there are already discovered significant natural gas resources. They're very large. And a lot of them are associated with the oil production that's going on out there. The gas is being reinjected. So certainly, I would think that there's a significant potential for natural gas production off of these associated fields and gas fields that have been discovered offshore. But the economics have to work, and the stakeholders who have a play in these developments have to be all on board. And these are hugely expensive capital projects. But someday that may happen. Now, let's get back to New Brunswick. New Brunswick has a significant natural gas resource in their shale. The Sussex field alone, the one that Corridor was and now Headwaters involved in, you know, is estimated to have 60 BCF of gas alone. And there are other formations, shale formations in New Brunswick that could have similar amounts, larger amounts or lesser amounts. So that's a very large number. It's hard to put into context. It wouldn't be amongst the biggest gas potential shale gas fields in North America, but it's a very significant one. It could supply the needs of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick for decades if it was developed. But there are challenges to significantly develop those resources in New Brunswick.
I want to talk a little bit more about natural gas in New Brunswick. As you mentioned, Corridor Resources, did they originally develop the Macaulay Field near Sussex, And, you know, it produces natural gas seasonally during the wintertime, I think, right? It doesn't operate all year round. You know, you indicated that the potential gas reserves in that field alone was 60 BCF. Tell what does that mean, Phil? How big is that? Can you give us some idea? Because that is a term that nobody would really know much about.
Well, I can only equate it sort of to the usage that goes on in the Maritimes. So the Maritimes uses a fraction of a BCF a year in gas.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a very large number in comparison to fields in the Appalachians and the Montney out in British Columbia. It's quite small, but it's still a very significant resource.
And what does BCF stand
billions
for?
It's billions of cubic feet.
Okay. Billions.
We can give you that in metric too, but it won't help you, and I'm getting too old to convert it.
I think that, you know, the emphasis on billions is probably helpful. Now, if those resources from that one field were developed, what royalties could the province of New Brunswick expect from developing those resources? I know that's probably a tough question, but can you give us a ballpark of how meaningful would those royalties be to the province?
Well, I can tell you this. Excuse me. It's very meaningful, obviously. Let's just talk about the capital requirements to develop the field fully. That would be in the tens of billions of dollars with all the spin-offs from direct and indirect jobs, which shouldn't be discounted. There's a lot of work that would have to go on to produce this product. And of course, royalties are dependent on gas prices, normally in the formula. But if that were fully produced and fully extracted, it would mean billions of dollars to the New Brunswick government also over the entire run of the project, which might be, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years. But I'll give you an interesting thing, Don.
Yeah.
In British Columbia, just recently, starting last year, the government revenues from natural gas production exceeded their entire revenues from the forestry industry. This is in BC. And BC has a pretty significant forestry industry, as you know. So natural gas there now has become the leading resource in terms of government filling government coffers. And that's going to increase significantly as a new LNG export terminal comes on board. It's coming on board this year and it'll be in full production next year. So that just gives you the significance of what can happen if you develop a natural gas business.
Could I just follow up on that, Phil? We were talking earlier this week about how gas is developed in BC. Most of it is from shale as well, is it not?
It's almost entirely from shale now.
And BC has very strict environmental regulations, probably among the strictest in the country. Is that right?
They have very strict environmental regulations. That's for sure. In comparison to Alberta, I would say, yes, stricter. In comparison to other locales in North America, very stringent regulations. In comparison to the world, Canada and for that matter, the U.S., they have far more stringent rules than most of the major producing nations, far more. So I would argue that, and I know I'll get opposition to this, but if you're going to produce natural gas or oil, North America is certainly the areas where it's produced on the most environmentally sound basis.
So there's a lot to learn from British Columbia. They also have done good arrangements with First Nations. They own pipelines, so they've been a key partner in the development of the industry. Can you, Phil, this may be a little off topic, but and maybe you don't have it at the tip of your tongue, but can you give us a sense of how far those natural gas fields are from the LNG plant? Like, did it require a significant amount of pipeline to get that gas to where it needs to go?
It absolutely did. It required a pipeline that TransCanada, TC Energy built, called the Coastal Gas Link. That pipeline was originally budgeted for, I want to say, $5 billion, might be slightly less than that. Anyhow, the cost of it came in at $14 billion to build that pipeline. Now, it's a big pipeline, and it's capable of moving 2 or 3 billion cubic feet of gas a day, but it was way over budget, very significant.
So I wanted to ask you then, how much did it cost you to connect the McCauley gas to the main pipeline here in New Brunswick?
Oh, gosh.
You remember that number?
I don't, but look, I'm going to take a guess that as memory serves me, it might have been $10 million.
Yeah, it wasn't $14 billion. Let's
stick with that. It wasn't even in the realm, and it's in good shape, and it's still operating very nicely.
Yeah, I've been out to that site, Phil. I did a tour a couple of years ago, and the first thing I thought when I got there was, where's all this infrastructure? I assumed there'd be, you know, massive gas derricks everywhere and all this sort of, and there was incredibly limited environmental footprint out there. And I think a lot of people don't know. At the time, I thought if we took every New Brunswicker and gave them a tour of that facility, it would probably change their understanding, at least, of the natural gas sector. I wanted to ask you about that moratorium that was put in place in 2014. It was basically around the same time as you resigned as CEO of Corridor Resources. Was there alignment there? Did you just get frustrated after that moratorium was put in place? What was the connection between everything that was happening in 2014 and your decision to step down from Corridor?
Well, there was some frustration on my part. We had worked so hard, not just in New Brunswick, but also in Quebec, to develop some, and offshore, offshore Newfoundland, to develop some great potentials. And in New Brunswick in particular, the effort we put in was, it was extreme with all the stakeholders. So I guess I would say I was burnt out on that regard. It wasn't that I was mad at the company or mad at any individual in New Brunswick, but it was a point of frustration, and I needed to move on to other things.
Can I ask? It's been a few years ago, and I have some battle scars from that time too. But I wanted to ask you if you had some thoughts for listeners about why what happened, what led to that moratorium. I mean, of course, there was a broad-based public campaign. There were signs everywhere. You can still see some of those signs in Albert County and other places even today. But what went wrong? Like, one of the questions I always wondered, and maybe you and I had this conversation, I'm not sure, is where was the onus for getting public support? Should it have been on the firms, or should it have been on the government, or should it have been on the communities? Like, where, I think that was something that went wrong, was we never really did a great job of explaining to people, until maybe it was too late, until they had sort of a preconception about what the industry was. So can you, if you want to take a trip down memory lane, give us a sense of what you think went wrong?
Well, where's the onus? I guess ultimately, if a company's trying to develop something and they don't get it developed, the onus is on them. However, what I would say is, you know, there were numerous stakeholders that had to be brought on board. Of course, First Nations, the local population in the area you want to develop. You have to bring on board a very uninformed civil service, very uninformed, and a bureaucracy that, apart from the leadership, and by the way, I'm very aware that your existing premier wants. Would like to see this resource developed. I'm very aware of that. But the bureaucracy didn't necessarily want to bring it on themselves. Inside the bureaucracy, there were views that we shouldn't be doing this. And then there was the political pressures from, some very favorable proponents, particularly in the Sussex area, to very unfavorable proponents in other areas of the province, who couldn't be convinced elsewise. And then there's, is everybody being delivered the right information? In my view, no, that didn't happen. Whose fault was that? Well, you could point the finger at a number of people there. I guess that's all I can really add to that.
Yeah. So, and of course, one of the big issues was the extraction technique, the hydraulic fracturing, or what they called fracking, So that term was used to conjure up a lot of pretty negative images about water contamination, about earthquakes, and, you know, basically everything you could imagine. Can you give our listeners a little primer on fracking? Not a sort of hour-long seminar, Phil, but just a little understanding of what actually happens there.
Sure.
And what was being proposed in McCully?
Sure. What it essentially is after you drill a well, and these wells are drilled horizontally now, and they're drilled for into these gas formations that are tight, they're drilled for 2 or 3 kilometer lengths. Fracking involves injecting water at a high pressure into those horizontal wells that are perforated to essentially go in and break up the rock. And it opens up pores in the rock, which allows the gas, which is under significant pressure under the ground because of the depth of it, to flow up the surface. Now, the water has to come back out of the system first, and that's the frack fluid. The frack fluid does have some additives in it and picks up some substances when it comes out of the ground. But typically what's done there is it's put into holding ponds, and there's a settlement process and a cleaning process that goes on, and then it's reused. And in the industry today, in the U.S. and Canada, there's massive amounts of fracking going on. The U.S. and Canada combined are producing natural gas at a level that no one ever thought possible, and they are by far the biggest producer of North America is of natural gas. And in fact, we're gaining huge economic benefit from it, particularly in the U.S., through the export of this product, which will be a transition fuel for probably the rest of my life. So it's the regulations are in place to do this in a reasonable manner. Let's not forget that in the energy business, I don't even care if it's renewables, nuclear power, hydro, to produce energy, that there's always issues around environmental impacts that have to be handled. And we can talk about solar, and I can give you some, you know, reasons that where there's concerns there, wind turbines, etc. To produce energy takes systems that have impacts. That's just that's the physics of the whole deal.
Let me just extend the conversation a bit. I want to talk about the history of fracking. How long has it been around? Seems like it's the dominant way of producing natural gas today. And can you talk about, you know, the impact on groundwater, which it seems to be one of the big concerns that people have. What is the evidence of harm done to groundwater from fracking?
Fracking has been going on for decades. In fact, the early cases of it were many, many decades ago. However, it's only in the last 25 years where it's really become the prominent procedure for production of oil and gas in North America. That's because the traditional reservoirs were running out of steam, so to speak. So now remind me, what was the rest of your question?
Well, just that, like I remember the big discussion in New Brunswick was, groundwater.
Sure. So, the concern there would be that when you were fracking a reservoir, a gas reservoir, that somehow the water you're using to frack those wells would migrate somehow up into the water table that's used for public consumption, agriculture, etc. So one must be, and that would not be good, but you have to keep in mind the geology that's done and the studies that are done to ensure that a fracking operation won't migrate up into a water table. And that's a significant concern for any company undertaking this operation, because that would practically destroy the development of that operation. I think if you look at history, there is an astronomically low occurrence of that. Has it occurred? Yes, probably, but it really is. If the right science is undertaken, there's no risk, in my view.
The current government in New Brunswick under Premier Higgs has signaled a willingness to lift the current moratorium on natural gas exploration. I want to ask you, what needs to be done to attract new investment from the oil and gas sector to fully exploit the natural gas reserves, especially in southeastern New Brunswick?
Well, we've started talked about the history here. What needs to be done is that there are a number of stakeholders that have to be brought on board for this to occur. That includes First Nations, of course. That includes the local residents, who are predominantly, in my view, when I was there, in favor of more development. That may have changed, but I don't think so. Subject to check. As I mentioned before, the bureaucracy needs to be come on board, and they need to, I think, enlist the help of others, like the bureaucracy in British Columbia, for instance, the government there, who's so familiar with the rules and regulations. I know that they started trying to do that, but I think that effort sort of fell on deaf ears after a while. And then, of course, there has to be a political will, not just from the premier, but from a lot of others who may be reticent about this opportunity. But if you look at the benefits that it would bring, I really think it makes a lot of sense to have another look at it. But Don, I will tell you, there is, one other key element to this. This takes a lot of capital, tens of billions of dollars to bring that whole development into a large scale operation, if that were to occur. And it's risky. Let's not fool ourselves. This is there's lots of risk attached to this. I'm not talking about environmental risk. I'm talking about the risk of the operation returning a fair capital return to those who invest, and the time it takes to get that done. So right now, commodity prices for natural gas, I've mentioned, are relatively low. And it would be very difficult to convince someone to undertake a program in the present state. But we should keep in mind, things move in cycles. And it's a very cyclic industry, the natural gas business. And there'll be a time again when prices would help promote this potential development. Not to mention the prices in the Maritimes are higher than anywhere else now, because we're at the end of the pipeline systems, and that there's a big benefit in that.
Yeah, and we're importing somewhere around $400 million a year in natural gas between New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. A lot of that's for industrial use, but yep, also for power generation and residential use as well. So it's a huge part of our trade deficit in this region that we have to bring all that in, and we have it under our feet. But I guess I wanted to go this next question a little deeper with you. Corridor Resources is now called Headwater Exploration. How optimistic are you that those reserves will be developed? You say it's very capital intensive. There's no guarantee that there's going to be a good return on that investment. There's still political turmoil and so on. So maybe just going a little deeper on what it would take to convince a company like Headwater to develop these resources. Do they need a special royalty rate? Do they need some sort of long-term offtake agreements? Like what would it take to get the investment it needs, even around length of time? What's the payback? Is it 10 years, 20 years? you know, the big talk here is that, yes, we need gas now, but maybe we won't need it as much in 10 or 15 or 20 years. You've said earlier in our conversation that you think gas is going to be an important part of the mix into the 2040s. So how optimistic are you that this could go ahead with Headwater, and what would it take to make that happen?
I'm cautious on that at this point. What would it take? Number one, Headwater themselves would probably, that they're a nice sized company, but they're not that large. And they wouldn't have, at this point, the capability of undertaking a major development there. Maybe they will in 5 years or something. I don't know. It depends on how successful they are in Western Canada with some some exploration and production they have out there. They would really rely on another larger company, either Canadian or U.S., who not only have the capital, but they have the expertise to come in and do this. Because it really is a special expertise. And, capital is one thing, but a more important resource right now, in my view, not just in this industry, in most industries, is the people knowledge and the people. So they would need another company to come in. For that company to come in, as I said, gas prices would have to be better. They will be at some time. It's cyclical, I can tell you. What they used to say is the cure to low gas prices is low gas prices, because that will self-correct over time. But the party coming in would absolutely have to see a willingness by the government, by the politicians and the government, and for that matter some other stakeholders, including First Nations, who could benefit greatly from this. And you see what's happening in BC, David, you mentioned it. So they would have to see a significant willingness from those stakeholders and those parties before coming. And that's not, and by the way, the premier's position is really appreciated, but it's not just the premier that has to be on board.
I wanted to ask you a question about the two natural gas utilities we have in the region. You talked earlier about how they have virtually brand new pipes, or some of the most pristine natural gas distribution infrastructure in North America. I know Liberty, I'm not as familiar with Heritage or with Eastward Energy, formerly Heritage Gas. I know Liberty has a lot of debt against that infrastructure that has to be paid off over a period of time. We wanted to ask you about the future for these natural gas utilities. We had in the past the CEO of Eastward Energy, John Hawkins, on the podcast talking about the future of natural gas. What's your sense there? What do we do with those pipes? What do we do with all that debt that's sort of that was incurred to lay these pipes down? You know, is there a future for natural gas in terms of the utilities in our region?
Well, absolutely. And I can't speak for Liberty too much, although I'm very familiar with it. It's been a while since I've looked at their situation. But I can, you know, give you some background on my view of this for Eastward Energy. And I would start with reminding you of something I said earlier. That pipe has got a long life. The debt that's built up in these utilities, to me, is not a concern. That's typical for all utilities. And they have debt metrics they have to follow, and they're regulated on that. Now, they do defer some of their costs to be paid out later, but with very strict formulas that they're granted by the regulators. Now, if you look at the industrial needs of Nova Scotia and the needs for Nova Scotia Power to eventually get off of coal, and I don't want to speak ill of Nova Scotia Power or Emera, nor would I. Great companies, but getting off of coal by 2030, come on, it's not going to happen. Sorry, I hopefully get off of some of the coal, through natural gas, some baseload natural gas, and also some quick response. But again, this is one of the reasons we're saying that, and Nova Scotia is a great example, that gas usage isn't going down. In fact, it's going to grow over the next 15, 20 years. It has to if we want to stop burning coal. In Alberta, they've shut down all their coal plants. They were burning per capita a significant amount of coal, and they're all I don't think they're given enough credit. They're all on natural gas now. All these power plants, they've been converted, it does have a great benefit to the environment. Now, getting back to the heritage system, it's very new, extremely low concerns around leak rates, a big supplier of industry, of power production, with more to come. But a unique thing about these systems is they're mostly plastic pipe, especially in the distribution areas around where the high populations are, like in Halifax. And these systems can easily take hydrogen up to a certain percentage. So Heritage, Eastward Energy is actively working on a hydrogen production system now with others, where they hope to, in the near future, inject, I think it begins with about 5% hydrogen into the system. And they're working on the approvals around that and the economics of it. But that system could probably take 20% hydrogen blending to be with the design of the system as it currently is in place. And that hydrogen production, of course, would come from renewables, from wind energy, converted through electrolysis to hydrogen. So there's a great future in that. Frankly, I'll be more basic. It is an energy delivery system. That's what it is. And as electrical usage and load grows, and it's going to grow significantly, in Nova Scotia and everywhere else in North America and in the world, you know, the projections are that electrical demand in North America will grow by 50%. In the world, it's two or three times that, because they don't have the same baseload supply right now. So these are systems that are in place to deliver energy. And there's not enough wires or capital to put more wires in to possibly deliver the loads that are needed to supply our growth and provide us with reliability. Reliability is singularly so important and not recognized. Now, it's becoming recognized in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, but there's a huge issue around reliability with our electric systems. And natural gas can aid in really helping out the reliability of those systems.
It's one of the things that confuses me as a layperson here is this difference between electricity and liquid fuels. Over 100,000 homes in Nova Scotia are heated with oil. And of course, all of our vehicles are all use a liquid fuel. Of course, natural gas is a liquid fuel, but we seem to be focused 95%, at least the forecasts that I've seen, on electrifying everything. And I suspect a company like Eastward or Liberty or any of these natural gas utilities are trying to make the case for using this infrastructure and continuing to use liquid fuel, whether it's renewable natural gas or blending hydrogen and things like that, to continue to have this kind of diversity of your fuel mix and not relying 100% on electricity production for all your energy needs.
Well, David, a couple of things. Renewable natural gas is taking place, you know, really through the capture of methane in waste facilities, dumps, etc., agricultural facilities. There's a lot of that going on now. And I'm sure Eastward Energy will be involved in that at some point. But, you know, when you talk about you brought it up, so I have to say, you know, the delivery of fuel oil in the Maritimes, and what the government, for political reasons, recently did to reduce the carbon tax on heating oil, but not reduce the taxes on natural gas, carbon taxes on natural gas for heating, is beyond me. And it's it was really it was shocking for me to say, see, and frankly, it's very divisive for the country, what was done there. It's not viewed as fair at all from Western Canada. And it frankly isn't fair. But anyhow, I digress.
There's a lot of widows and pensioners in rural Nova Scotia heating with oil. So I understand, you know, the fairness of it, but I also understand the politics of it. It was a very, yeah, very complicated thing.
Yep.
Recently we had Peter Gregg on, the CEO of Nova Scotia Power, talking about his company's plans to transition to renewable energy. And he talked about the possibility of converting, as we mentioned earlier, some of the coal generating plants to natural gas to ensure baseload needs are met. That must present a pretty big opportunity for Eastward Energy, does it not?
Sure, it certainly presents an opportunity, because that gas has to be transported to those facilities. I think an example of that might be the Trenton plant, where there would be plans, I think, for some baseload electrical production from natural gas, and a number of places where they want to put in these smaller quick response units, they would be off of the, at least in some cases, the Heritage Gas system. So there would be the requirement to build a pipe to that specific location and then provide them gas. So yeah, most certainly there's an opportunity there. I would think that Eastward Energy and Nova Scotia Power are talking about that. And I think there's some very interesting stuff that could happen there.
Phil, I mean, you still have pretty strong connections to Atlantic Canada. You're back often. Looking at what is happening in Atlantic Canada today, especially with the drive for green hydrogen energy and offshore wind, how optimistic are you about the future of the region?
Well, I do go back very often, and will always. Although we retired out to Kelowna in 2016, we kept our house in Halifax up into and including through COVID. We weren't able to really get there too much. So we eventually here a year and a half ago sold the house. Anyhow, and I certainly get back as much as I can because I love the area. But I'm very confident of the future of the Maritimes because it's a great place to live. The education system's fantastic. The quality of life there is very good. So I think it can look forward to a great future. If you're specifically talking about the future of the energy development in the Maritimes, I think that's more of a challenge. We've alluded to some of that already. So there has to be more acceptance of the various industries, including the renewables, and how they get developed. And there's upsides and downsides to all of this. Another example of that would be nuclear, small nuclear, which I think has to be part of the solution. It absolutely has to be. But think, Don, if I said, oh, I'm going to start building a small nuclear plant, and by the way, it's going to be next door to you. You know, would you accept that? I don't know. But so, and again, the technology will be there to do that, but it's going to take a long time to develop that. But certainly hydrogen has absolutely got a role to play and will, and the renewables also. These all have to be done in a way, in my opinion, though, that ensures that the product, especially electricity, is affordable to the residents, especially the residents who can least afford price increases in that product. So there's lots of challenges, but I think the future is great.
Well, Phil, we've been talking about doing this podcast for a while, but we're really pleased that we finally got it done. We thank you for joining us on the Insights podcast and providing us with an overview of the current state of the oil and gas sector and the natural gas opportunity in New Brunswick. We are anxious to see the outcome of the current efforts to develop those resources, as I'm sure you are as well. So thanks again.
Thank you. And thank you, David and Don. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Phil.
You've been listening to the Insights Podcast from the Acadia Broadcasting Corporation. Follow the show and listen to past episodes on your favorite podcast platform, like Apple or Spotify. If you've enjoyed the show, why not recommend it to a friend? Don and David will be back next week with another deep dive into some key issues in Atlantic Canada.